Okay, so as I mentioned, we're in for a treat today, but the movie we're looking at is called The Song of Lunch, and to present that for us, please give a big welcome to Tina Kamatha. Here she is.
I gotta get the Wiggles out. I'm a little bit nervous, but I see friendly faces, especially Charlotte. Thank you for staying in with me. So if I've never met you before, my name is Tina Kamatha. My husband, Steve, and I have been coming to Cedar Ridge since around 1995, we figured it out. So I was a high school student over at Paint Branch High School, Go Panthers, right around the corner. And there was a little church that was meeting in the building on Sunday morning. So I decided to check it out, and then the rest is history. So I've had the privilege to do a couple of these God in the Movies in the past, and I am always a little bit nervous, even though I'm a pretty outgoing person. It's vulnerable to be up here, and I feel a little bit of imposter syndrome sometimes when I'm trying to share a message. So forgive me if I make any bumps and bobbles along the way. I'm going to lean a lot on my own kind of personal experiences and reflections. I'm going to use probably some more contemporary Christian writings versus a lot of scripture because that's where I feel more comfortable. But then Steve's going to come up at the end of the service and do a reflection on a longer piece of scripture for us to kind of lead us into communion. So before I introduce, if you didn't get to see the trailer in the beginning, before I introduce the movie called The Song of Lunch, I have to warn you that I have pretty quirky movie taste, and my family does not always agree with my viewing choices. Steve will attest to it. So I like documentaries, foreign films, anything with like subtitles, and I've made this category or categories called the three A's. And I'll put it up there. So I like anything that's artsy, a little bit awkward, and has a lot of angst. And the movie that I picked is all the A's. It's a little quirky. So let me explain why. I've seen The Song of Lunch a few times. I think a friend of mine mentioned it, and I decided to watch it back when I had COVID, so I was watching a ton of movies. And this one stood out to me for a couple of reasons. So it's not a traditional feature, like long feature film. It's actually only 45 minutes long. It's a short, I don't think it even came into the movie theaters, actually. It was run on the BBC back in 2010, and it's a little duet between two actors, Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson, who I love, absolutely love both of them. They're old friends. They've worked together on a number of movies, including Harry Potter, which you probably have seen them in, and then this was a little side project that they did. Unfortunately, Alan Rickman passed away in 2016. It's not a traditional movie also in the sense that it doesn't follow a regular script. It's actually the narration of a poem, so that fits all the A's for sure, artsy, awkward, and angsty. It was written by a British writer named Christopher Reed, and it might make you panic a little bit in your seats if you're thinking about watching a poem narrated all morning long, but I promise it's not going to be like high school English class. I think it brings it to life in a way that if you just read the poem, you might not get the same feel from. I'm going to show the first kind of string of clips. So one thing that's a little bit awkward about it is Greg Manson in the back did an amazing job stringing together the clips for me. So you'll see sometimes there'll be a little bit of a black screen or pause, and then the next clip will come on, so forgive us, but I think it'll help kind of string it together a little bit better. So we're going to do our first clip in just a second. When we meet him, oh, that's one other thing I needed to mention. The characters don't have names. They're just referred to as he and she, but I'm probably going to refer to them as Alan and Emma just to make it clear. So we meet him, or he, in his London office. He's working as in a publisher's office as a book editor. He's kind of unfulfilled in his job. He's tried to write. He was successful in writing one book of poems. But other than that, he hasn't really been able to kind of get his writing career off. So he's a little unfulfilled in his job. He's deciding he's going to take the afternoon off. He's set up a date with an old flame, Emma. They haven't seen each other in something like 15 years. So as you can imagine, he's a little bit nervous. He gets out of his office. He's going to walk over to the restaurant. He kind of reminisces about what their times there were like. And then he kind of gets settled in to wait for his date. So that's the first scene that we're going to see.
He leaves a message, a yellow sticky on the dead black of his computer screen. Gone to lunch. I may be sometime. His colleagues won't be seeing him for the rest of the afternoon. Rare joy of truancy, of bold escape from the trap of work. That heap of typescript can be left to dwell on its thousand offenses against grammar and good sense. His trusty blue pen can snooze with its cap on. Nobody will notice. He shuts the door on the sleeping dog of his own departure, hurries, not too fast, along the corridor, taps the lift button, and waits. To meet even one person at this delicate juncture would sully the whole enterprise. But he's in luck. The lift yawns emptily. He steps in, is enclosed, and carried downwards to sunlight and London's approximation of fresh air. With one bound, he is free. The restaurant is an old haunt, though he hasn't been there for years. Zanzotti's, unreformed Soho Italian. Chianti in a basket, breadsticks you snap with a sneeze of dust. Red gingham cloths overlaid on the diagonal with plain green paper ones. Finger smears at the neck of the water carafe. And Massimo himself, touring the tables with his fake bonhomie. But Soho has changed. The speciality food shops pushed out of business. Tarts chased off the streets. And a new kind of trashiness moving in. Cultureless. Fly-by-night. But hey presto. Zanzotti's edges into view exactly as memory has preserved it. Phew. When he suddenly recollects. What, precisely? Deja vu? Some artistic analogy? Too bad. Let it go. On the threshold. On the edge of a shadow world that is yet to welcome him, he stands and waits. But who catches his name in his right ear, then bows clerically over the ledger that bulges from all the names, the months and years of names written in it, and that sits open on a slope like a church lectern Bible. The Book of Reservations. As ever, that pause of anxiety and mute appeal. But there, happily, it is scriptural confirmation. Without a smile, without a word, he is eyebrowed. We said we wouldn't look back. Why did she email him suggesting? No, he did.
So I absolutely love the rhythm of the movie, so that poetic kind of speak as he goes through. And again, like I said, I love Alan Rickman. So the flow feels a little bit different than a traditional movie, maybe. The whole film is almost entirely narrated inside of Alan's head. He gets settled at his table. He orders a bottle of wine out loud, audibly to the waiter. He actually does talk on that part. And then he kind of awkwardly sits there and waits for his friend. So the theme that jumped out at me while watching the film is the concept of our internal voice, or our internal monologue. And I don't know if you guys are like me, I am talking to myself constantly. While I'm sitting there while the movie's going, I'm replaying things. While I'm up here, I think there's also a little running narrative going. So I always have something kind of jumbling around in my brain. My family thinks that I'm loud on the outside, but I'm actually pretty loud on the inside too. So one thing that I thought about as I was kind of prepping for this week is, back in the day here at Cedar Ridge, we had an acting troupe called Act One. I don't know if any of you remember it. I know there's a few. Kevin's in the back waving because he was one of the actors. And so a while ago, Steve English, who I'm not sure if he's here, but he did a one-man kind of play that was related to the morning's message. And it was kind of looking at the idea of your distracting internal voice. So I thought it was kind of brilliant. He was sitting in the audience, and he just looked like every one of you guys, smiling and sitting comfortably, paying attention to the speaker. I hope you are paying attention. But what we could hear over the auditorium speakers was the main speaker's voice kind of faded away, and then we could start hearing what was going on in Steve's head during a regular Sunday morning message. And while he would try to focus, most of the time his brain went off into another world. So he was replaying an argument that happened back like over the week with a coworker. He was going over a conversation that was happening with his spouse that morning. He was making a list about the grocery items he needed to pick up after church. And then my favorite part of the skit was 999 used to come over the board. I think it's gonna come up. So I don't know if you remember, we used to put 99 up on the board whenever there was, we needed all hands on deck in the children's ministry. So when Steve was in the audience, he was trying to really focus, and he saw 999 go up, and he started turning it into a song. So he was going 999 and 999 and 999. So he was distracted the entire time. Welcome to my own internal ADD brain. That's exactly what happens to me. Sorry to Ruth and Matthew or any of the other speakers that come at Cedar Ridge. So C.S. Writer writes, and I'm going to have that slide come up, and I'll read it from my notes so I can see it a little bit better. The moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush in at you like wild animals. And the first job each morning consists of shoving it all back and listening to that other voice, taking that other point of view, letting that other larger, stronger, quieter life come flowing in. And for me, the moment my eyes pop open way too early sometimes, hopes and dreams for sure come rushing in, but so do anxieties and fears and to-do lists and all the other things that kind of bombard my brain on a daily basis. So as I was prepping for this morning, I was reading about that concept of internal monologue. And as you can imagine, there are a million studies about the human brain. And the structures of the brain and the chemicals of the brain are a lot easier to study than human thoughts. They're a little bit more subjective, but there are some people who are amazing. We're able to start making some studies that studied our thoughts. And a simple study that I read about was the researchers decided to have the subjects in a room, and they were working on, they had them working on like a simple task. And as they were doing the task, periodically the researchers would stop the subjects and then have them document what they were thinking at the moment. And so people would document and then keep going with the task. And what I saw in the study, which surprised me completely, was that some of the people, as they were doing a task, were thinking about absolutely nothing. I think they are lucky ducks. I don't know if they just have kind of simpler, quieter minds, if they're able to focus in and hone in on a task a little bit better than I am, if they have something that distracts them and bubbles up and they're able to let it go much easier. But I don't have any of those qualities. There are some benefits, as I was reading about internal monologues and voice, for having kind of a running commentary. You can plan, you can do some emotional regulation, you can do some problem solving. So there's positives. There's a functional inner voice that I think has benefits. You can give yourself some positive reinforcement, motivation, instruction, all of those really good things. For me, unfortunately, my internal voice often takes a dysfunctional turn. So I can be my own worst enemy at times. I think some of it comes from some trauma, some childhood things. I talk to myself a little bit like my parents did when I was younger, even though I'm an almost 46-year-old woman. I have a running narrative that can be pretty critical, excuse me, and can be distracting at times too, just like we saw with Alan, and we're gonna see a little bit more as as Emma shows up and he tries to have conversations with her when it's mine. Kind of takes a turn. So sometimes my internal narrative can cause a little bit of separation. I'm thinking or overthinking something. I'm thinking some of the worst thoughts, and I disconnect a little bit from the humans that I'm trying to interact with or from God as well. So we're going to go into this next string of clips. This is a little bit longer string of clips, and it's kind of this awkward. We'll be able to see much of what happens during the date. And we'll see Alan's narration get a little bit in the way. So any meetup with an old flame could be awkward. I can't quite imagine what that would look like, but we know it's going to be problematic kind of from the get-go, and then you'll see Alan kind of get distracted multiple times during the conversation. So we're going to have that.
His tumbler of water, overweight bubbles mobbing up to greet him, sips that and feels the chill fizz smash against his palate. Thirstier than he thought, he drinks till the ice rests on his upper lip.
Hello.
She's here. How did that happen? Had he taken his eyes off the door for so long? Flustered, self-reprimanding, he is still able to start to rise from his seat.
Well, I didn't see...
And be met halfway with a soft peck smack in the middle of his mouth. Familiar collision of pout against pout. What's the toast?
Happy days.
Happy days it is. Rims meet and clink, swaying the cradled liquid. Dark, sluggish ink. And they drink. Becoming palatable.
You haven't changed.
Oh, I have. Witness this morning's bathroom mirror, the grey, the flab, the stoop, the frown, and in the deliberating, disbelieving eyes, something like terror.
Not to notice.
Did he play the wrong card? Could things be turning nasty? Retreating to cover, he concentrates hard on the antipasti.
No salts. Be nice, Soissage.
Cajoling English and caressing French.
How long has it been? 10 years. 11?
15.
No, it can't be that. Let's settle for 12. And we've only got lunch in which to tell each other everything, so... Truce?
For a moment, he withholds. Mouth full of pores. Which he can either spit out or swallow. What's the use? Pax. And he finds it difficult to look her in the eye, which is bright, amused, searching, pitiless. But he has to try. A sip may help. When he notices for the first time the faint nimbus of the lens circling the gold-shot azure of each iris. Well, of course, oracle eyes he used to call them. The harder you looked, the more sublime and unreadable they became. But have they lost their old force? The heretical question strengthens his own stare. Gaze meets gaze, revealing as ever everything. And nothing there. Fly away thought. Back to life. And you?
Oh, the good wife and loving mother. That keeps me occupied. I've no complaints. And Paris is a fabulous city. You really should visit.
He has. But is it the moment to mention that crazed escapade? But he's interrupted by mention of a book he's actually written. His own. His only.
I read your book. Are you working on any more?
No. No. Not a squeak. True. The Muse of Misery, so lavish in her attentions for a year or two, has not revisited, and that modest volume of 36 wounded and weeping lyrics remains unique. Not that the world cries out for more. One shitty review in the TLS and its round of common room sniggers and put the dampers on that. Sales scraped through to three figures and the once gung-ho publisher ceased to return phone calls. An illuminating history of betrayals. The book, conceived in tears, will be born drowned. No swaps this time. Conversation on hold, the scuffle and clack of her cutlery send out signals not difficult to interpret. But he's soothed by the ambient blur. The big white noise of a room that's full of anonymously feeding humans. Even the too near table of boisterous boys contributes to its euphony. Its equilibrium. There is peace at the heart of the din. Concord in Babel. Then a kick on the shin.
This is ground control. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
I seem to have hurt your feelings.
Oh, sure. I've had my feelings surgically removed. They can't be touched by anyone now.
Penny?
Sorry?
Your thoughts?
No, thinking. Exactly. More probing a mental dimension beyond time and space.
Typical. You can't even pay attention for the few minutes we have. I've come all this way, dropped my family at not the most convenient moment, hopped on the shuttle, taken the taxi ride from hell, convinced at every traffic light I'd be late, and here I am, all tuned up for our little reunion, only to find your physical, guzzling, tippling self recognisably present. But your mind appears to have flitted off on holiday. You're out to lunch at your own lunch.
Okay, so oof. That was pretty awkward. Again, it's only 45 minutes, so if you have streaming, I can't remember which streaming service is on, I would recommend watching the whole thing as it plays out, because it's a little bit more smooth, but I wanted to show you the most kind of awkward, intimate moments. So it's easy as an outsider when you're watching Alan to want to just kind of like snap him out of the thoughts and things that are going on in his head and have him be present. And I think if somebody was listening to my own internal tape most of the time, you'd want to do the same thing. You'd be equally frustrated with what's happening in my own brain. So the movie is really a string of these kind of awkward, slowed down, aching moments. They're poetic and beautiful, but they're painful for sure. All the internal things that are happening in Alan are happening in this very public space. He and she are sitting across the table from each other, and they're kind of trying to match the same wavelength they had back in the past, but they are completely unsuccessful. And one critic I read a little bit about, a review about the movie, and they said it's very interesting. There's such poor communication happening between two adults, even though Alan is speaking almost the entire time, inside of his head, unfortunately. Instead of being present and connecting with Emma, he's completely distracted, and she says he's out to lunch at your own lunch. So I think some of it is rooted in the fact that he feels a little bit left behind by her. So his life hasn't turned out the way he expected. She's gotten married, she's moved to Paris, she's living this kind of seemingly glamorous life where he feels like things have taken a turn that he didn't expect. He's kind of failed at what his big hopes and dreams were when they were younger, when they were together. And I'm sure we all feel a bit about that, feel like that ourselves. Life doesn't always turn out the way we expect. It's not very linear, and we don't see it kind of going in the perfect plan direction that we thought it would. I have a little graphic. This is what I think my life has looked like. On the outside, I'm living this nice suburban life, and I have a family, a nuclear family and everything, but the straight line is kind of what I thought would go. This kind of represents my own life and my spiritual journey too. So I kind of thought things would go once I kind of came into Christianity and my spiritual walk. I thought things would just kind of go smoothly, and they have not gone that way. They've been kind of a muddled mess. I think growth is like that too. I don't find growth very linear either. When we had our kids were little, we had that growth chart in our laundry room. I don't know if you have one of those where we measured their height. It was very easily straight, narrow, easily measurable. And instead, I think growth looks a little bit more like this. So I don't know if you have any funky trees in your yard, but we have a couple of funky trees that have taken turns, have tried to move around obstacles, reach out for the sun. I feel like that's kind of where my growth journey has gone. It's been a little bit more winding, not straight and narrow. So Christopher Reed's poem is a story of lament and longing, nostalgia and regret too. Alan's found that life, like I said, hasn't always turned out the way he expected. I feel for him, I feel that way too. Life sometimes feels one step forward, kind of two steps back. Things in my life have zigged sometimes instead of zagged when I expected. And I found that in my head anyway, I can kind of get stuck in the lows, kind of where Alan's gone to. So I'm always kind of bravely looking forward and trying to acknowledge those tendencies and then move forward. A great analogy, I thought about Mr. Donahue when I thought about this. I heard a cool analogy about cars, actually, about growth, and about a stick shift car. So we have a couple of kids. Our youngest is getting ready to drive, which is scary, and we have a stick shift car for them. So they're going to be learning how to, their first car right off the bat will be a stick shift. And the analogy that I read about was that about growth and slow growing growth and transformation. So it might be counterintuitive if you've never driven a stick shift before, when you're going from gear 1 to 2 and 3 to 4 and so on to go faster to get the car to move forward, the car actually goes into neutral for a little second, and so there's this lull. The car slows down for a second and then goes forward, slows down for a second and then goes forward. So I'm trying to think of myself a little bit like an engine. I have times in my life where things feel like they're going forward, and then I'm taking benefit in, or finding benefit in the pauses, because I have inevitable pauses, inevitable times when life kind of slows down and when I wasn't expecting it to. I've tried fixing some of the thoughts I've had in my head. I've tried to do some work. Sometimes I'm more open to God being in the mix with that, and sometimes I'm not, and I kind of shut things out. I tend to address it in a very heady way, and so I'm trying to work it through in my brain. But sometimes I actually think the work I need to do is a little bit more heart-focused. I've had some heartbreak, some trauma, so I think heart-focused needs to be kind of my next step of my journey, a little bit more spiritual-focused. So I'm going to share a little writing from Mother Teresa, who we love, and I'll put it up on the board. I'm going to read it here. There it goes. There she is. So Mother Teresa reminds us, "I always begin my prayer in silence, for it is in the silence of the heart that God speaks. God is the friend of silence. We need to listen to God, because it's not what we say, but what he says to us and through us that matters. God speaks in the silence of the heart, and we listen. And then we speak to God from the fullness of our heart, and God listens. As this listening and speaking is, this listening and speaking is what prayer is meant to be. Prayer is not always asking, but prayer is putting oneself in the hands of God at his disposition and listening to his voice in the depth of our hearts." So I think this is bold, but I think if Mother Teresa met me, we would have been buds. I think we would have gotten along pretty well, although she probably was nice to everybody. As we come to God, she calls us to be silent first, and I am absolutely terrible at that. Anytime there's any kind of awkward silences, I tend to fill that space with noise. I'm not sure if any of you guys are like me. I love her line, "God speaks to us in the silence of the heart, and we listen. And we speak to God from the fullness of our heart, and God listens." So I'm working on being someone who stops and listens, sometimes stops my own self, stops and listens to the other humans that are around me, and then I'm trying to listen for God's voice too, because I want to be somebody with a full, healed heart. So we have one more section of the film, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more. Maybe you guys have got this down pat, and this is not something that you're struggling with, your internal voice, heart, or feeling like you're doing okay, and maybe it's more that you're trying to kind of calm down the noise outside of you. The world around us can be loud. There's a lot of noise pollution. We have earbuds and Netflix and Hulu and Prime and news feeds and all the things. So maybe that's something that you're working on. So I think some of the things we'll talk about after the last clip, maybe we'll apply to that if you're not following more my wavelength, where I'm trying to quiet more my internal thoughts. So our last clip shows Alan trying to give it a try himself as well, to have a little bit of quiet. Lunch has turned pretty tragic at this point, so he's going to take a step away and try to quiet the noise within, and then I'll talk a little bit more after we watch this clip.
To the very top. He sits. An erupting pigeon briefly interrupts otherwise silence. Non-event. Now he can't decide whether to weep or sleep. Thank you. He is woken up by somebody waking up inside him abruptly and roughly. After some seconds' ugly tussle, he identifies his assailant as himself. They reach an agreement, encourage each other to consciousness, and become one. What is he doing, crouched on this high shelf? The brick view illuminates nothing, but a wheedling smell, mixture of kitchen wafts and structural mildew, helps him to recall. Lunch. Oh.
So, that clip is very close to the end of the movie, and I won't give away the ending, but Alan escapes to the roof. He tries to quiet himself, flee from the noise. I think it's his own noise, really. And it's the first time in the film, actually, where we don't hear him thinking or speaking much of anything, and of course he falls asleep, drifts off into this kind of ethereal dream of what once was. He's snapped back into the present and then hurries to try to go rescue what's left of the lunch, but I won't tell you what happens. So as I was thinking about it, I think maybe part of this work is not just about fleeing from the noise, not just quieting the thoughts, although those can be important too, but also to really remain in the present, acknowledge the thoughts and feelings, grapple with them, give them over, and kind of listen for God's voice, especially in the fray of my own. Some strategies have worked for me, but I am messy and a work in progress, as you can probably sense from my talk already. I've tried a few things to help kind of calm, kind of meditative practices, contemplative practices. There was one here actually a while ago, it's about 10 years ago, I think, with Patsy Fratnawando, an old staff member, and she was leading a small group in a meditation exercise, and I was gonna give it a go, because it's not really my first go-to wasn't to meditate, especially at the time. I'm getting a little better at it now, but I was gonna give it a try. So I sat in the chair, and she was telling us a little bit about what the practice was gonna entail, and then she said, if you have any distracting thoughts that come up, one of the tricks she wanted us to do was have a little notebook or a piece of paper next to us, and if something kind of bubbled up as you were in your meditative place and praying, you could just kind of take the paper, write it down, and then leave that thought on the paper, and maybe that would be something you could come back to after the meditation. So it was kind of a way to like put it out of your mind and then return back to the practice. So I did it a few times, and I wrote something down, and then I came back to the practice, and I was really struggling and kind of like working hard to stay in it, and then another thought bubbled up, and so then I wrote it down on the piece of paper. I forgot about it, went back to the practice, really tried, and then what ended up happening is I was doing way less meditation and way more just like writing a to-do note and like thinking of all the things I needed to do for that week and the problems I had, and so I'm sure if anybody had opened their eyes, they would have seen me just like furiously writing something on the paper, which maybe is what I needed to do in the moment, but it probably wasn't Patsy's idea in terms of the practice. So like I said, one step forward, two steps back always with me. But there are two contemplative practices we've done here at Cedar Ridge that have been helpful. So we're gonna kind of walk through both of them. This is a reminder for me to do them too. I will be honest and say that I don't practice either of them with much regularity, but I'm trying to get a little bit more of both of them in my kind of weekly, I'm not gonna say that I can do it daily, but weekly kind of practice. The first one is called the centering prayer, and I put a couple bullet points up just to feel fancy, because Matthew and Ruth always put bullet points up, but I'm not going to follow them directly. Here's my bullet points. So for the centering prayer, this one is actually pretty challenging for me. The next one I'll share is a little bit easier for me, but this one is hard, because it really is just kind of being quiet, quieting your heart and mind and creating space for God. No specific objectives, really just trying to be present. So I'm sure there's many iterations of the practice, but we'll kind of walk through this one. So you can start with 5 to 10 minutes at a time. That's about as long as my brain will let me do it for, but you guys might be able to do it for a little bit longer. I have to set a timer too, and I have to let the clock mind the time, or else when I have my eyes closed, I like constantly keep peeking at the clock to see when I'm gonna be done, and I'm like 2 minutes in or something. So let the timer mind your time if you're like me. And then, kind of get into a quiet space if you can, and put your hands on your lap and kind of open them up if that feels comfortable for you. So as I already said, the notebook trick might work for you. It did not work for me. So two things that do sometimes work for me to kind of bring my brain back into focus. And one is to come up with kind of a touchstone or anchor word. So I use that word, I'll kind of say it to kind of get me into prayer. And then if I feel my mind kind of going into another dimension, then I bring that word back in and kind of help me bring back into focus. And since I have to do that pretty often, I try to do a pretty simple, basic word like Abba or peace or calm or something like that, where it's just short and sweet and I can kind of repeat it to bring myself back. I did get to do a meditative practice this week with a friend that was leading something, and she wanted us to focus on our breathing. So that's another way to, we've done that before here at Cedar Ridge, to focus on your breathing to kind of get you back into practice. But what was happening to me was my breath, I could not keep up with the way she was doing her breath, so I felt like I was drowning almost, because I was trying to hold my breath for four counts in and four counts back out, and I was focusing too much on the breath and was panicking. So what I have found for me is that I breathe at my regular rate and rhythm, but I focus on the pause in between the inhale and the exhale, and for some reason for me that helps, so maybe that'll be something that works for you. So as your thoughts or distractions arise, call to your mind your word or breath, let it bring it back to the practice. And then when you're done, after your timer goes off, or if you sense you're done with your quiet time, if you don't need the timer like me, then you can kind of thank God for the practice. And then don't do what I do. So try to be non-judgmental about what you did. So I tend to go into this weird place where I'm like, did I do it right? I'm not good at this meditation stuff. I don't even know if I heard God saying anything. So the goal will be to not do any of those things and just to trust that the practice over time will help transform your heart and bring you a little bit closer to God. And then the second practice, which we've done here at Cedar Ridge often, is called the welcoming prayer. A little bit different. This one's a little more forgiving to, I think, my brain and mind activity. I can do it in a quiet space where I turn everything off, but I can also do this like at work. I'm a nurse. Pretty easy job that I have. I'm not in an intensive unit or anything, but there's moments when I have stress during the day or something is bringing me anxiety. So this is one that I can actually do kind of in the middle of my day, like an ordinary daily moment. I still get a little bit of a quiet space, but I can do it kind of periodically in like patient room when they've left or something like that. So same thing, couple deep breaths, get into a peaceful posture. And then as you're going into this kind of quiet space, you just start to notice what's bubbling up. So thoughts, emotions, commentary. So we're actually welcoming the thoughts and emotions that are bubbling up versus trying to just quiet them, which I think that's why this one connects with me a little bit more. And then simply notice what feelings are coming up. And usually for me, it's something anxiety producing. So I try to feel it and welcome it, just be open and sense kind of what's bubbling up to the surface. And then as we repeat welcome, we kind of welcome God too in the moment. So when I feel something, I tend to internalize it in my gut. Sometimes I feel it in my heart. So sometimes when I'm in the welcoming prayer, if I sense something like that, I put my hand where I'm sensing it in my body, the sensation, and then I ask God to come there. And then, I think I'm trying to figure out where I'm at, sorry. And then, so I ask him to come to my body. I welcome you here. I know that you have something to teach me. So the feelings that bubble up, kind of how I referenced earlier in childhood, sometimes those feelings or thoughts are rooted in some unhealthy attachments. And we've kind of gone through this before at Cedar Ridge, trying to figure out where those needs might come from. And there's a few categories we've used that kind of, not catch everything for sure, but can kind of help kind of direct you in something to release back to God. So you're looking at whether maybe it's attachment or security, safety, self-esteem, power, or control. Sometimes we get stuck there, and that's where I tend to get stuck too. And when I'm in those spaces, I tend to react as I did when I was a child. I regress a little bit. Those root causes sometimes can become unhealthy motivations as we're moving through our day. They control us a little bit. So if I sense those feelings, and usually for me, it's acceptance or esteem, I try to put my heart where, or my hands where I feel it. Feel the feelings, let it teach me something. We don't want to numb or push down, tamp down the feelings. They're there, they're real. But I do want to release them sometimes when I feel like they're controlling me in the moment. So in the welcoming prayer towards the end, as you kind of have sat there, breathed, welcomed, felt all the feels, then we want to let go. So we can say something like, I release my need for esteem. or I release my need for power or control in this moment. And sometimes if I can't label it, kind of back to the song that we sung this morning, I just say, I surrender my all, and kind of keep going. So these both take a lot of practice, and for me, it's lots and lots and lots of practice. I'm not particularly strong in either of those, but I'm trying. I take a yoga class at my work on a weekly basis, mostly, and this Thursday, we were trying some really advanced yoga moves. We were doing these crazy poses and stretches that I felt way beyond my capability, but the teacher is amazing. It's a safe space, and so she was walking around as we were like fumbling and being in imbalance and making mistakes and reattempting kind of the various moves that we were doing, and she used a phrase that stuck out to me. She said that as we're making all of these mistakes and we're working, doing hard work, that we could be compassionate witnesses to each other and to ourselves. And I got kind of distracted just ruminating on that as I was trying to balance, but I'm particularly kinder and sweeter and more compassionate to the people around me than I am to myself. My internal voice can be pretty brutal sometimes, and so I need compassion for myself, and I think even though I don't always invite God into this, I feel like God is a compassionate witness to my madness and crazy. So I see growth, like I said, albeit winding, and I'm in a different place than I was 5 to 10 years ago, but I have a long way to go. I'm almost done. I have one more thing I'm going to share with you. So I'm an avid library goer. I have a list on my Montgomery County Public Library, like wait list, that's like 100 books long. And I found a new author, or she's not new, she's new to me. She's Catholic, she's in her 90s, her name is Esther DeWall. I have about 5 of her books on my waiting list. I think one's ready at White Oak this week, so I'm going to pick it up soon. But this is a book that she wrote called Lost in Wonder, and I kind of love this little excerpt. So she says, uncrowd my heart, O God, until silence speaks in your still small voice. Turn me from the hearing of words and the making of words and the confusion of much speaking to listening, waiting, stillness, and silence. To seek God means, first of all, to let yourself be found by him. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God of Jesus Christ. He is your God not because he is yours, but because you are his. To choose God is to realize that you are known and loved in a way surpassing anything you can imagine, long before anyone had thought of you or spoken your name. So we're going to wrap up now and head into communion. I really appreciate you guys letting me be up here. Steve's going to help me. He's going to come up and do a reading of Psalm 46, and we're going to do a little reflection at the end where we're going to kind of practice a contemplative reading of the last few words of the psalm. So as Steve comes up, go ahead, get comfortable, stretch, or take a couple deep breaths if you need to, and be present and still and welcome God here.
So, as Tinica has said, now we're going to enter first a reflective practice, a meditation moment. But let me just spell out the communion instructions that we share each week. This morning, just after we finish our reflection, all of us are welcome to participate in communion. Here at Cedar Ridge, each week, communion is a time for each of us to reflect, to actively participate in different ways, to pray, and to share the present moment as a community. You will be invited to come and take a piece of gluten-free cracker and a small cup of juice. You can eat and drink at the tables at the front or the middle, or you can take it back to your seat, whatever feels most comfortable for you. Also, during communion, you can light a candle located at the back of the auditorium, and that can be a form of prayer, or it can be a symbol of light. You can light a candle or write out a prayer for Ukraine at the back right corner. You can also spend time in reflection at one of the racial justice stations up here at the front. You may want to pray with somebody at the back, or you can write out a prayer at the stations under either the Journey or the Grow banners, and you can set those in the frames, and a team member will pray for you during the week. You may like to make a financial gift at this time. We have the wooden towers in the back, and you are also invited to either sing or just to listen as we share music here. So having gone through those instructions for communion, let's Now take a reflective moment to look at all of Psalm 46. After I read this passage aloud, we will enter 2 minutes of meditation. That's when I invite you to close your eyes, relax, breathe, and listen. It will be one verse repeated, but on a different ending word to focus on. We will have a few moments of repeated silence. And again, we are here to be present, to be calm, to be. So here's Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble with its tumult. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city. It shall not be moved. God will help it when the morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar. The kingdoms totter. She utters her voice. The earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord. See what desolations he has wrought on the earth. She makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. She burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. So, Greg, if we could bring the lights down. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Still. Be. At this time, you are all invited to communion.